Serving New York State and Southern Ontario, you're listening to WDCX FM Buffalo, WDCX HD1 Buffalo, and WDCZ AM Buffalo. WDCX AM Rochester and WDCX HD1 Rochester.
Welcome to Neil Boron Live. Real talk that gets to the heart of the matter and music that inspires. NBL is the place for information, motivation, and encouragement. So drop the mask, pick up the phone, and get ready to join the conversation at 1-800-684-2848 or 883-5000. And now, here's Neil Boron, live.
Hey, everybody. Good to have you with us on a Monday edition of NBL. Some warmer weather has arrived back in Western New York and Southern Ontario, and everybody's smiling. And by the way, did you catch the Masters yesterday? I didn't actually see much of it. Just actually a couple of holes. But Scottie Scheffler, who won the Masters, gave glory to God, saying, "I play to the glory of God. Ultimately, I want to glorify God in how I play golf." And congratulations to Scottie Scheffler, first-time winner of the Masters tournament. Some of you are avid golf fans, and you saw that whole thing. It's pretty incredible that he used the opportunity on national television to give glory to God. Well, I've talked about this last week. I want to bring you up to speed. This is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and you know as well as I do that there have been an awful lot of stories emerging, especially recently, about child abuse that's happening in all kinds of places: schools, summer camps, Christian ministries, churches, youth ministries, sometimes in homes. It's happening everywhere, and it has happened for years everywhere. Finally, people are beginning to report and come forward and talk about some of the damage that has been done. What you need to know is that the vast majority of churches are unprepared to deal with this kind of thing. If somebody were to say, describe in some detail what your prevention plan is for child sexual abuse, or what the requirement, what the procedure is for reporting if something is discovered, how it works, what the policies and procedures are for the church on these kind of things. And most of you would say, well, sure, my church is against abusing children, so there must be something in place. But the vast majority of churches are ill-prepared to deal with this kind of thing, and we're talking about the very children that God created in His image. So we're going to talk about it in detail this week when Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe joins us. She's the founder of Ministry Safe. She and her husband, Gregory Love, are attorneys that have dealt with the issue of sexual abuse for more than three decades. And over time, they began to see some patterns emerging, similar things that were coming to light regarding almost all the stories they were hearing, and began to realize there are some actual identifiable aspects to this that if we understood in advance, we could watch for. We could be better equipped to stop sexual abuse dead in its tracks. And by the way, why do child predators gather in places like churches? Because that's where children are. You know, if there's a bunch of bunny rabbits eating in your backyard, coyotes are going to be not far away because they see lunch. The bunny rabbits enjoy your backyard, but the coyotes see the lunch that's waiting in your backyard. And that's exactly what child predators do. So if churches and Christian ministries and Christian summer camps are where people are being abused, how do we understand the grooming process? What are we supposed to know about abusers in general? Help us with some of the facts. Define some of the misconceptions we have. How do you handle reporting procedures? Who's required to report? Do we know the answers to any of these? Well, the sexual abuse awareness training from Ministry Safe is extensive and it's powerful. And we're going to talk about certain aspects of it this week. Kimberly Norris will join us in a few minutes here. She'll be taking some questions tomorrow and on Thursday. We've got a bunch of information we're going to be sending your way. But Lord, bless this conversation this week. We pray that you would open our eyes and our ears and our minds and our hearts to receive what you have for us about how we can protect the children that you gave us, you entrusted to us, those little ones that are shaped and formed in your image, God. How do we protect them from child sexual abuse? It's not going to be an easy topic to talk about, but Lord, I pray that you would enlighten us, encourage us, help us to see the hope that's involved, and help us to get equipped to be better at identifying this problem and dealing with it boldly and courageously. We pray in Jesus' name, amen.
Trusting Jesus to see you through and learning to do things God's way for Worship Wednesday for short.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and So I guess it makes a lot of sense that we'd be talking about child sexual abuse, and particularly as it relates to churches and Christian ministries. It's not the only reason we're doing it here in April. It has to do with the willingness and availability of Kimberly Norris, who's part of a law firm called Love and Norris. Gregory Love, her husband, and her also are the founders of Ministry Safe. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But Kimberly is a sexual abuse trial attorney, and she represents victims of abuse, serving as a consultant and testifying as an expert in abuse cases, providing crisis management and allegation response counsel to child-serving organizations, really of all sizes. And they work with major Baptist state conventions, colleges, universities, Christian camp associations. If I really went through all of the credentials that Kimberly has, it would probably take up all of our time together. So I'm not going to do that. But Kimberly, I want to welcome you back to NBL. You were a part of a special series we did on some abuse that occurred here in Western New York State in the fall, and just grateful that you're willing to join us here on NBL. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
So, Ministry Safe, it's you're part of a law firm, but Ministry Safe is kind of a side thing that you, it's not small, but it's something that you guys do on the side. Can you describe what that is so that we get a better grasp before we even begin?
Yeah, so I am a sexual abuse trial attorney. I represent victims of child sexual abuse in a tiny little context. If I'm actually in the courtroom, it's in a circumstance where a child has been sexually abused while his or her parents were participating in a cult, and the abuser had spiritual authority over that child and over that family. In other words, the abuser used that spiritual context to essentially fish for kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing that for 3 decades now. A few years into that endeavor, we began to see patterns in the way that abusers accessed children through faith-based contexts. And to the point where today, when I get a phone call from someone seeking representation, I can finish the story for them. But interestingly, the standards of care are identical in Christ-based environments. So standards of care are what was allowed to occur that should not have been allowed, mm-hmm. or conversely, what should have been in place to protect that child from sexual abuse in terms of training, screening, policies, supervision, et cetera, et cetera. The standards of care are identical to Christ-based environments as they are in these realms in which we were litigating in situations involving cults. So Ministry Safe grew out of our desire some more than 25 years ago to take these standards of care, to take our expertise, to be able to show the church Christ-based environments, Christian churches, Christian camps, Christian missional organizations, the misconceptions that they commonly encounter, the ways in which individuals access children through trusted positions in spiritual contexts, and to provide resources to the church, capital C, such that we could do a better job at protecting kids from sexual abuse.
And we need to. And, you know, there's things in life that we don't want to believe are true, but the reality is that sexual abuse happens in churches, and sexual abuse of children happens in churches. I'm saying this name for no other reason than it's just a place where I see things printed about sexual abuse in churches, but a casual check of ChristianPost.com periodically shows you that there's youth pastors being arrested for putting cameras in the Christian school bathroom, or, you know, caught with child porn on his computer, or pictures of some of the kids in, you know, states of undress on his phone. And I'm not picking on youth pastors. It's senior pastors. It's people in leadership positions. We've heard so much of it. And the point is, kids gather in churches. And then, I mean, so if they're gathering there, then that represents a feeding site for wolves, right? I mean, if the sheep are there, the wolves are going to show up and feed. And if you could comment also on the fact that, in my opinion, churches make the perfect place for somebody to try to get away with this, because churches believe in forgiveness, and you know, we don't want to judge others. Jesus said, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." So, who really wants to believe that a trusted person
is abusing a child. Can you talk about that whole dynamic for us? Because churches seem like the perfect place for a predator to show up.
So a couple of things. The churches and Christian ministries drop the ball in two specific contexts. One is failing to properly respond to an allegation when it comes to their attention. And that can happen in, you know, it can be outside in allegations, something that's happening in the child's core world or something that happens someplace else at school, at camp. You know, it doesn't have to, outside in allegations or things that happened out there, but the child talks to somebody, a trusted adult in ministry, and those allegations are not properly reported and followed up on, et cetera, et cetera. Secondarily, when the child is communicating an allegation related to something within the ministry, and so it's a staff member or volunteer who's alleged to have inappropriately interacted with this child or sexually abused this child, and that's the second way that the church tends to drop the ball. I think that the church, and I'm using this as a capital C, so any Christian ministry, but the church is uniquely susceptible to this risk for a lot of different reasons. We are grace-based. We say, come as you are, no perfect people here. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that was before he knew Jesus. We are not licensed, and I don't think we should be licensed, because I don't want any more government in my life, and I certainly don't want it in my church. However, because we're not licensed in the church, certainly not in the traditional church context, some camps are licensed, obviously, but because we're not licensed, there are no continuing education requirements, there are no licensure requirements that would require us to keep up with standards of care and protective protocols that are required in child-serving environments. We tend to believe that people's motivations are pure and appropriate. We think if somebody wants to work with kids, they ought to be able to work with kids. And that's just not always the case. So we are uniquely susceptible to this risk because we believe people. And we tend to, many church folk don't have a category for the type of behavior that leads to the sexual abuse of a child in that program.
I remember you saying in the fall that the typical abuser isn't somebody, it happens, of course, but isn't somebody who pulls up the side of the road in a minivan wearing a ski mask and jumps out and grabs your child, an abduction kind of thing. That way more often, it's somebody who's actually known to the child. So maybe comment on that as well. And then, you know, how is it that people who are known can seemingly get away with this in the midst of others who have eyes and ears and but somehow don't readily spot what's going on? How is it that others aren't more aware of what's happening?
Sure. So when I ask a ministry, what do you have in place to protect kids from child sexual abuse, assuming, you know, I'm able to even have that conversation,
right,
what I hear about are two common answers. Matching tag systems, you know, let's give the baby back to the person who brought the baby. We have some basic security protocols in our building, in our children's wing, in our student ministry wing, and we do criminal background checks. So the church is ascribing to the principle or the idea of stranger danger, mm-hmm. that the danger to children comes from outside the proverbial fence. And the reality is that 90% of kids who are sexually abused by someone they know and trust. So it's not a stranger. It is somebody known to the child, typically known to the family. And this is because the majority of the cases that I'm encountering in ministry context are at the hands of the preferential offender. And the preferential offender is an individual who prefers a child as a sexual partner. Almost without exception, preferential offenders have an age range and gender of child with whom they would prefer to have sexual interaction. So preferential offenders tend to gravitate toward situations where the age and gender of child preferred is gathered for them. So they gravitate toward employment and volunteer positions to gain access to kids within their age and gender of preference. So on the flip side of that,
No, go ahead.
You know, there's the background check that most churches run, and for many churches, it's the only screening process they have in place as it relates to child sexual abuse risk. And the problem with this is that it's not a silver bullet. Less than 10% of abusers will encounter the criminal justice system ever. I'm talking any time during their lifetime.
Wow.
Department of Justice back. DOJ a few years back said less than 3% of abusers will encounter the criminal justice system ever. So the criminal background check is not the silver bullet that the church thinks it is. And those two realities combined really leave the church wide open to the preferential offender.
That's like trying to sift sand with a chain link fence. I mean, a couple of grains are going to get stuck on the links, but otherwise everything's going to go right through. If that DOJ number you mentioned, if that's correct, that means there's an awful lot of people who I think feel a sense of comfort saying, well, we did a criminal background check. But that means that it's likely 97% of people who are offending children who have no criminal background won't be discovered in that context, which means you have no protection or virtually none. That's shocking.
Yeah.
Talk about grooming behaviors briefly. I mean, we're going to get into a lot of this week. Tomorrow, we're going to specifically deal with how to recognize grooming behaviors and prevent child sexual abuse. On Wednesday, we'll be talking about some more about sexual abuse awareness, but also implementing an effective strategy in a ministry environment. And then on Thursday, we'll be doing some live Q&A with Kimberly. So we're going to have a lot of access to Kimberly this week. Grateful for that. But talk about grooming for a minute, because that's such a big part of this. How is it that oh, and by the way, Rachel Den Hollander, who blew the lid off the Olympic scandal with the gymnasts and Larry Nassar and that whole thing, I read an article from her who said, you know, well, so much was made of that event, and it was horrific. He abused hundreds of USA gymnasts. That her first sexual abuse occurred in a Sunday school room when she was a little girl. That a college student was working in the ministry, had her sit on his lap during some kind of a film they were showing. She was 7 or 8 years old or something, and he put his hand up her skirt, and he began touching her repeatedly on several weeks in a row. And she describes the horror that caused in her life. And then how do I tell? Because everybody loves this guy. He's like the greatest guy. Mm-hmm. How does the grooming process work? And obviously we can't talk about it in great detail, but what is the grooming process?
So every preferential offender past a certain age has two options in terms of gaining access to children within his or her age and gender preference. He can either bring the children to himself by surrounding himself with kid magnet kind of stuff, things that kids would like to do, or he can go to where kids are gathered. So those are the options past a certain age. Preferential offenders participate in grooming behaviors. They groom a child for sexual interaction. And it's a process, and it's a process that is viewable. And because it's viewable, it's also preventable with proper supervision. But the second concept that happens without exception in my experience and my 30 years of law practice in this realm is molesters groom the gatekeepers. They groom church leaders. They groom parents. They groom coworkers to believe that they are helpful, trustworthy, responsible people. And they do this because what every preferential offender needs in order to inappropriately touch a child or groom that child for sexual interaction, they need trusted time alone with children in the program.
Mm-hmm.
And ministry leaders, much less parents, will not give trusted time alone to an individual that they do not deem to be trustworthy. So molesters go way out of their way in these kind of settings, preferential offenders, go way out of their way to convince the people around them that they are helpful, trustworthy, responsible people. And in Christ-based environments, that includes I've got a testimony that sounds legitimate and credible, and I believe what you believe.
You know, it's all kind of terrifying, really, because how can you know? I mean, sometimes when we hear, you know, major ministry, like a Ravi Zacharias, for instance, so many millions of people were blessed in some fashion by his ministry. And people stand back and say, no, there's no way that could happen. But it did. And so, you know, you could imagine some people would listen to a conversation like we're having and just say, I'm never leaving my house. I'm not going anywhere. I'll watch my own kids. I'm not going to ever put them in the care of a sports coach or send them to a Christian summer camp or something where they're going to be groomed and the people around them will be groomed and everybody's going to think everything's fine. But my child will still be in danger. And we're not trying to present a sense of hopelessness. I think it's obvious that what you're doing, Kimberly, can go a long way to help churches and camps and sports teams and other be better at handling this kind of stuff. But describe, if you can, the training that you do, because you guys have trained some 2 million people to spot grooming behaviors and to have a more effective safety system in their church. I've looked at some of those videos. I mean, there's a 78-page accompanying manual. It's unbelievable the detail you guys go into. But talk about that for a minute, because I want our listeners to realize there's resources available to you through Ministry Safe that you can avail yourselves of that will really help.
Yeah, so the answer is not to wrap our kids in cotton balls. Heads up, they won't let you do that anyway.
Exactly.
The answer is not to live in a fear-based construct, because that's neither biblical nor practical. The answer is to arm ourselves with good information. So you're right. We've trained over 2 million ministry staff members and volunteers online or in person over the last 25, 26 some odd years. And what we do, the whole purpose of the training that we offer is to give ministry staff members and volunteers eyes to see, ears to hear, grooming behavior, the grooming process and common grooming behaviors, because those things are viewable. And these grooming behaviors should be addressed in policies and procedures. And, you know, adequately supervising our ministry programs such that no single adult, or at least it's very rare that a single adult would be one-to-one alone with a kid where no one else can say what did or didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So there's an awful lot of this that is can be addressed through proper training, an understanding of the abuser's grooming process, an understanding of common grooming behaviors, and a willingness to open our eyes to the issue and be proactive rather than reactive. You know, let's not wait till the catastrophic scandal hits. Let's be proactive about protecting children in our care.
Yeah, there's so much we want to try to cover this week. We won't get to all of it, but I do want to mention right off the bat, and I've got one or two other quick questions for you, but because it's National Child Abuse Prevention Month, Kimberly, you guys are doing a thing where parents can actually access the parent training video free of charge, I believe. You're doing it free of charge at ministrysafe.com. And if you want to just briefly comment on what you say in that video, what's presented there, because there's a lot of information about preparing parents to be better at equipping their own children.
Sure. So parent training is free for the entire month of April. You can access it at ministrysafe.com/April. ministrysafe.com/April. It's a training that I recorded. I'm a mom. It's a training that I recorded speaking directly to parents. Here's what you should be aware of. Here's what you should understand in terms of the grooming process of the abuser. Here's what you should be aware of in terms of having protocols in place to protect your own child from sexual abuse. Just to give parents eyes to see. And the back end of that training includes a Q&A between my daughter and I. My daughter is currently a second-year law student at Duke University. And it's some Q&A between she and I that was not rehearsed. Just asking her, what were some of your takeaways? What did you experience? What did you see? How did this feel to you? Et cetera, et cetera. So we just address what parents should know. We should talk about, you know, parents are concerned about, I don't want to frighten my child. Well, you know what? Your kid already knows more than you think he or she knows, because they're hearing it 24/7. They're inundated with sexual topics from our culture as a whole. So it's just an exhortation to parents. Let's get in the game. Let's start these conversations early so that they're not strangely awkward. Instead, the lines of communication are open. So I encourage parents who listen to avail themselves of access to that training.
Yeah, and it's free for the month of April. Utilize what's there. It's powerful stuff. You go to ministrysafe.com/April. And if you forget the website, we've got that link pinned to the top of our WDCX Radio Facebook page. So if you go there and just click on it, it will also provide you with access to the parent training free of charge during the month of April. That's incredible, and how gracious of you. Just want to, real quick, I know we're short on time, but Kimberly, let's just speculate, or, you know, let's kind of make up a case study. Because I'll give you an example. When my kids were little, our kids were little, we went through a plan. What to happen if there's ever a fire? What would we do if there was a fire in the middle of the night and you had to go out that window and we went out this door? And, you know, where do we meet? What's the plan? And we took time to talk to our kids about that. We worked out, you know, if you're ever lost, and what do you do? You know, exactly what's the procedure? So we loved our kids, and we took time with that. Well, what happens when you're a low-level worker in a ministry? You love being around youth and stuff, so you volunteer and you show up and you help with kickball, you know, during the sports aspect of the youth ministry. And then a young girl comes up to you during the break and says, "Mr. So-and-so touched me in my private area." It's the first thing you do. And I think, Kimberly, if we took a poll right now, most people would say, tell the youth pastor. You know, maybe the person the kid's talking about is the youth pastor. But, you know, what's the plan? Do we call the police? Do we immediately tell someone else? Do we tell the kid they're lying, which I don't think we do? But, you know, help us with something like that, because those are the kind of things that we hope to deal with a little bit later this week. So, and all of your materials go into depth on this kind of stuff. But, you know, all I'm saying is I think that the vast majority of people in churches are just ill-equipped to deal with this. We've never been trained. We don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some basics. First of all, every state has mandatory reporting requirements. And the trend, state by state, is that every adult is a mandatory reporter. Regardless of the trend, in every state, clergy are mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. So what you just described constitutes a mandatory report to Child Protective Services or law enforcement, which is 911.
Mm-hmm.
So some basics: listen and respond calmly, because the child needs that grown-up to be an adult in that circumstance. Be sensitive to vague or partial disclosures. So the number one reason kids don't tell: if I tell, no one's going to believe me. So if you can say, "I believe you," the two things an abuse survivor needs to hear when he or she approaches anybody, much less anyone in ministry: "I believe you. It's not your fault." So an appropriate report to authorities would need to stem from that. And that's not just a good idea. Failure to report is a crime in every state. So what you saw in terms of abusers is, it's a common reality. But the flip side of that is I've got a clip up on my PowerPoint right now that I'm adding to my training that shows 7 Christian school officials marched out of the building in handcuffs for failure to report.
Wow.
So the flip side of this trend is criminal prosecutions for failure to report.
Kimberly, I've probably been a part of maybe 10 churches or so throughout my life, just because of different places we lived and my parents church hopped a little bit when I was a kid. I can pretty much say that in at least 9 of them, for sure, there was some kind of a story about something that happened somewhere that most people were unwilling to talk about. And looking back and seeing some of the materials you guys have put together, I'd say none of them were handled in any way close to what you have recommended. And, you know, you've worked with hundreds of these situations, trained 2 million people to get this thing done the right way, and we're going to be thrilled to be able to go through some of this with you this week. We'll never answer all the questions, but I want to encourage you to go to ministrysafe.com and avail yourself of all the resources that are there. And by the way, as Kimberly said just a minute ago, during April, parents can avail themselves of the parent training absolutely free during the month of April. So absolutely don't miss out on that. Go to ministrysafe.com/April, or go to WDCX Radio on Facebook, and we've got it pinned right there. Anything else that you want to mention here quick? Because we're going to cover a lot this week. we can't cover it all. Maybe a word of hope or something. Any kind of a broad perspective before we let you go, Kimberly?
Sure. Well, the word of hope is that God is sovereign. He's in control. He has created good resources for Christian ministries and parents to avail themselves of to better equip themselves to protect kids from this specific risk. It's a known risk. It's a viewable issue. So, you know, it's not a hopeless situation. The answer is arming ourselves with good information. And as we arm ourselves with good information, we're better equipped to protect our kids.
Amen. The five-part safety system from Ministry Safe can help get you a long way down the road towards equipping yourselves, your kids, your ministry for how to prevent this thing. And by the way, if one in three girls are abused before the age of 18, one in five boys, and you're talking about 33% of the women listening right now, 20% of the men know exactly what we're talking about because we ourselves have been victim, you know, fallen prey to that kind of thing. So, Kimberly, again, thank you. And I pray, God, for Ministry Safe, for Kimberly Norris, her husband, Gregory Love, for the millions of people who've been trained, God, in the moment, when it's time, I pray that they would react appropriately, because what we're talking about is protecting the children that are created in your image. Help us to be diligent. The enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But God, we have the ability to seek help, assistance, training, and the leading of the Holy Spirit to do things the right way, to protect the children that are created in your image. Some of them are our very own. So God, bless us as we focus on this week on NBL. Use these conversations for your glory in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Kimberly, thank you so much. In just a couple minutes here, we're actually going to dig in and begin a session on some of the facts and misconceptions. We're going to draw some of that from your actual training video. So that's where we're headed. But thank you again, and we'll be in touch tomorrow here on NBL.
Yep, sounds good. Looking forward to it.
NBL, putting the spotlight on what Christ is doing in and through His church.
So thanks again to Kimberly Norris for joining us earlier to kind of set the stage for what's going to be happening this week. We'll give you opportunities to talk with her direct if you want to ask questions, share comments. We'll get to some of that on Tuesday and Thursday in particular. But we want to continue today by getting to some of the facts and misconceptions. Now, some of what you're going to be listening to are just portions of the entire sexual abuse awareness training, which is really ground zero. It's step one of everything that you can learn regarding how to protect children in ministry settings and in your homes. Skillful screening training is in addition to that, and they actually have seminary-level training now at places like Dallas Theological Seminary, beginning to introduce these concepts to people who are studying for ministry. Thank God for that, actually. So there are seminary-level courses as well, but we're talking about getting your ministry, your church, equipped to protect children. So what are some of the facts and misconceptions as they relate to child sexual abuse in ministry settings? Let's listen in.
My name is Kimberly Norris. I'm an attorney from Fort Worth, Texas. I'm one of the directors of Ministry Safe and Abuse Prevention Systems, and I'm a sexual abuse lawyer by trade. The purpose of this training, if you're watching this online, is to understand the facts about sexual abuse and sexual abusers, to understand the risks that are inherent in children's programming, and to understand the elements of an effective screening process. Skillful screening training assumes that you've already completed sexual abuse awareness training from Ministry Safe or Abuse Prevention Systems. If you've not completed sexual abuse awareness training, please stop now. Go back online and finish that training and then return. The purpose of this training is to understand the facts about sexual abuse and sexual abusers, to understand the risks that are inherent in children's programming, and to understand what are the effective elements of an effective screening system for organizations providing services to children or students. I want to start with some of the definitions and some of the concepts that we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training. We will not address each one of the elements from that training, but I want to do some brief overview of the concepts that you learned in sexual abuse awareness training, starting with the definition of child sexual abuse. A variation of this definition is in place in every state in the 50 states of the United States, and that is any tricked, forced, manipulated, or coerced sexual activity for the pleasure of the abuser. I want you to notice from this definition that child sexual abuse and child sexual abuse that can be criminally prosecuted can be physical, it can be verbal, it can be visual. In most states in the United States, you don't have to touch a child in order to sexually abuse that child. Some of the misconceptions that we addressed in sexual abuse awareness training. It isn't that big of a problem. Statistically, 1 in 4 female children and 1 in 6 male children will have been sexually abused in the United States before he or she reaches 18 years of age. 2/3 of abuse survivors, 66%, don't tell until adulthood, if ever. This isn't limited to any racial, ethnic, or socioeconomic class or paradigm. It spreads across the board. There is no part of town. There is no program. There is no spiritual element. There is no sports context that is not touched and impacted by child sexual abuse. These statistics are uniform in all different paradigms throughout the United States. On the offender side of the equation, we've got over 747,000 registered sexual offenders living in the United States today, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The number of victims on average for a male abuser prior to criminal prosecution who prefers boys as victims is 150 victims prior to criminal prosecution if that individual is criminally prosecuted. On average, male molester, male victim, the average number of victims is 150 victims prior to criminal prosecution. For a male molester who's criminally prosecuted for molesting girls and prefers girls as victims, the average number of victims is 52 prior to criminal prosecution, assuming that individual is in fact criminally prosecuted. In the U.S. today, the average age of criminal prosecution of the molester is in the 32 to 36 year age range. The average male molester begins molesting at 13 or 14 years of age. So you can see where there would be a long span of time if the average molester begins at 13 or 14 years of age and has 20 some odd years to create that kind of number in victims. On average in the U.S., the male molester has had his first victim prior to age 18 in 80% of the cases that are being investigated through the parole system. And studies related to molesters in jail who've been criminally prosecuted who'd like access or to participate in an opportunity for parole. 80% of those individuals say they had created their first victim prior to 18 years of age. And again, the average is 13 or 14 years of age. I want you to hear this from the mouth of an offender who was an athletic director, because I want you to hear it from the offender's standpoint in terms of the numbers.
I created my first male victim when I was 15. And I have been victimizing male children virtually nonstop until my incarceration. I have 11 male rape victims. I have one female rape victim. And I have approximately 1,250 male molest victims. And I say approximately because I really don't know. There were times when I went a whole week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks without ever molesting anybody. And there were other times that I molested daily, 2 and 3 times a day. On average, I would say I molested 5 children a week over that 20-year period.
The problem is growing, and offenders are going to go to where they can gain access. Rising standards of care are leaving some children's programming organizations behind because they're not doing it as well as some other children's programs in different contexts. Some programs rely too heavily on criminal background checks. As you saw in sexual abuse awareness training, the underlying training, relying on a criminal background check alone is an ineffective safety system, and it is an ineffective screening process standing alone. This is because less than 10% of sexual predators encounter the criminal justice system. The most recent study from Department of Justice indicated less than 3% of sexual predators would ever encounter the criminal justice system. What this means is that your criminal background check is working perfectly, which it is not, I assure you, but if it were working perfectly, you would get this little bitty slice of the pie of ascertaining abusers with some sort of criminal record that you can check and that you can gain access to. The great weight and majority of abusers do not have a past criminal history to check. We'll talk more about criminal background checks later and what constitutes an effective criminal background check, but this cannot be an effective standalone system as it relates to screening for individuals who want to have involvement in children's programming. Another concept we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training, stranger danger, the idea that we're going to stay away and keep our kids from exposure to strangers who may have ill intent toward them. Stranger danger has some limited effectiveness, but we must keep in mind that 90% of children who are sexually victimized are victimized by somebody they know and trust. 90% are victimized by somebody they know and trust. That can be a youth leader, a coach, a volunteer, a teacher, can be a family friend, can be a family member. So stranger danger is not a great protection. Another common misconception, I would be able to spot an abuser. I'd be able to look and visually ascertain whether some individual has the wrong intent toward children in my program. This isn't a great way of protecting kids because there is no visual profile for a sexual abuser. Most look like you and me. In fact, statistically, in one of the largest studies ever undertaken related to sexual abusers in the United States, some really startling statistical findings were made clear, and that is in a report or a study of 3,952 admitted molesters, male molesters who were participating in probationary studies, who admitted to having a deviant sexual attraction to children and admitted to multiple victimizations of children. In that study, the largest ever undertaken, these statistics were yielded. This was in 2001. 77% of the admitted molesters were married. In the U.S. Census for that year, 73% were married. 46% of the molesters had a higher education. In the U.S. Census for that year, 49% had a higher education. 65% were working of the molesters prior to their incarceration. 64% of U.S. males in the census that year were working, employed, gainfully employed. 93% of the admitted molesters considered themselves to be religious in some form. In the U.S. Census for that same year, 93% of males marked the category in the census describing themselves as religious. These statistics are remarkably close, and what it tells us in this very large study is that the average male molester, at least for that calendar year, looked remarkably like the average male in America, which means it hits the whole gamut, the whole socioeconomic. The average molester looked like the average male for that census year. Because there is no visual profile of a molester, because they look like you and me, they can be male, they can be female, they can come from every socioeconomic paradigm, they can come from every cultural paradigm, they can come from every ethnic paradigm as shown here. Another common misconception is that all molesters are men. Statistically, of convicted molesters, convicted sexual abusers, 90% are men, 10% are female. That statistic may be slightly skewed in terms of the actual molesting population, because in our country, in the United States, we do not typically criminally prosecute women as readily as we criminally prosecute men. for a lot of different reasons. Most of them are related to societal norms. We assume that women are caregivers. We assume that women have an innate desire and ability to care for children. We don't like to think of anybody sexually abusing children, but we specifically and societally do not choose to believe that women readily sexually abuse children. And criminal prosecutors know this. A woman is much more likely to get an opportunity to plea down to a lesser offense or not be criminally prosecuted at all. Nevertheless, in the convicted population, 90% men, 10% women, as well, we've got a pretty significant rise in peer-to-peer sexual abuse in the United States. In the last 6 to 8 calendar years, we've seen a 300% rise or increase in reported peer-to-peer sexual abuse. Almost one-third of sexual abuse that's reported in the United States today is peer-to-peer sexual abuse. Kids who are sexually aggressive with other kids that gets reported to law enforcement. Some examples of female offenders who gained access to children through their jobs, through their volunteer positions, through contexts where children were gathered in some form are shown here.
That's Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe. This week we're focusing on the issue of child sexual abuse, particularly as it relates to the church. We're going to do some open call time with Kimberly tomorrow, and there's a lot of ground to cover, including how to set up an effective child abuse prevention plan for your own church. But we're going to be dealing with topics related to this issue all week long. When we come back, we're going to look at the grooming process. How is it that people are able to groom children and later sexually abuse them seemingly right under our noses? How does that work? We'll get to it as NBL returns here on WDCX.
It takes less than 10 seconds. Grab your smartphone and like WDCX Radio on Facebook. Yeah, that's it. That's it.
April, as you may know by now, is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and we're taking some time here on NBL to help better equip you, or at least make you aware of resources that are available to help you and your ministry, your church, be prepared to spot abuser characteristics, understand the facts and misconceptions of child abuse, particularly in church and ministry settings, to recognize the grooming process. We've got a lot to talk about this week. We'll be taking calls tomorrow with Kimberly Norris when she's back with us again. We're going to talk about this all week long. We've got also, I want to mention, there's free parent training right now available for Ministry Safe by going to ministrysafe.com/April. ministrysafe.com/April. And parents, you can sit down and in 1 hour learn stuff you've never heard before about how to protect your children from child abuse, sexual abuse predators, even in ministry settings. Go to ministrysafe.com/April, or if you forget, just go to our Facebook page, WDCX Radio on Facebook, and we have it pinned to the top of the page there. We're going to be talking about this all week long. So the question is, now that we've understood some of the facts and misconceptions, what are standard abuser characteristics? How do you spot an abuser?
Because there is no visual profile of a molester, we have to look at abuser characteristics. And to do so, I want to briefly describe for you different types of molesters. Most of the major studies that have looked at this issue in the last decade are looking specifically at preferential offenders as those individuals who are responsible for almost 90% of the acts of abuse or sexual abuse in the U.S. today, and probably the world. The preferential offender is that offender who prefers a child as a sexual partner. That individual who could have an age-appropriate person of the same or opposite sex wanting to have sexual interaction with them and instead prefers a child as a sexual partner. This individual can fall into two separate categories. A true pedophile is that individual who preferential offender who prefers a child who's not yet entered adolescence or puberty, gone through puberty. Commonly, the age that's put on that is 13 years or younger, although for young girls in the U.S. today, the age of entering puberty has now come down to 11 or 12 years of age. So the dividing line is where the child has not yet entered puberty and therefore bodily changes have not begun, voice changes haven't occurred, body hair has not yet developed in the way that it will during puberty and on into adolescence. The other type of preferential offender is what's known as an aphebophile, and that child is an adolescent, has been through puberty, is generally over the age of 13, and the preferential offender who prefers that older child can be referred to as an aphebophile. Other types of molesters who we're going to spend very little time on as we describe the screening process is what's known as either the indiscriminate, sometimes the psychotic offender, the offender who is willing to have sexual interaction with a child, with an older person, with an elderly person, possibly even indulging in bestiality. This would be the indiscriminate offender. Not something that we're going to address with any depth in the screening process, because the preferential offender is that offender who poses by far the greatest risk to those organizations providing services to children. Talk about that more here in a minute. The last type of offender that we're going to discuss briefly is the situational offender. And that is that offender who might not seek out a child as a sexual partner, but will accept a child as a sexual partner under certain stressful circumstances. And this individual is somewhat limited risk in children's programming. We do address some specific screening elements toward that risk, but because that individual is not participating in a lifetime pattern of seeking out children of a specific age and sex, that offender tends to be of less risk and danger to organizations providing services to children. So our preferential offender is the offender that we're going to spend the rest of this training talking about. That preferential offender who experts believe is responsible for almost 90% of sexual abuse that happens or that occurs aimed at victimizing children. Almost all preferential offenders have a specific age and sex of preference. They'll sometimes step out of that sex of preference, the gender roles, especially for the pedophile. For the pedophile, we must understand that part of the attraction is to the young, prepubescent, hairless body that has not yet developed in specific sexual context, male and female, gender-oriented roles. So that molester will commonly step on one side or the other of the gender barrier. The aphebophile is a little bit less likely to do so. Nevertheless, almost all preferential offenders have a specific age range and sex of preference, a gender of child, an age range of child with whom they prefer to have sexual interaction. Many preferential offenders as well have a specific body type, body style, hair color, et cetera, which is physically and sexually attractive to them, as well as an age and sex of preference. This diagram, which we used in sexual abuse awareness training, describes the deviant sexual desire that is exhibited by a preferential offender. When that individual is participating in what's called faulty thinking, the ability to justify and rationalize the deviant sexual behavior, then that individual will be looking for access to children within his age and sex of preference. Some quick examples of faulty thinking, and these can become important in the screening context, screening process, because the screening process is going to include questions and include specific subject matters that are meant to elicit a high-risk response. And in those questions, inherent in the answers that you receive, you may sometimes see different elements of this type of faulty thinking, the ability to justify and rationalize deviant sexual behavior. Top of my list, we're not blood related. This would be some sort of caregiving role, foster, adoption, after school programs, sporting context, any context where some adult is in a position of authority and providing services to a child who is not his or her natural child. She asked for it, or she came on to me. This would be another common rationalization used by the molester, taking the position that the child, really of any age, but including very young ages, approached the molester, came on to the molester, seeking out that sexual interaction. And it's a very, very common justification and rationalization.
I was teaching him or her about sex is another common justification. You're going to need to know this later on. You're going to have a boyfriend. You're going to have a girlfriend. Here's what they're going to expect. You're going to need to understand what you'll have to participate in or understand or have knowledge about moving forward. I'm going to teach you how. This would be another common justification. People have been doing this for centuries. Adults have been having sexual interaction with kids for literally millennia, would be a justification and rationalization for that behavior. I'm not hurting him or her, or there was no actual intercourse. Some molesters will stop short of actual sexual intercourse with a child and justify to themselves and rationalize to themselves that the child was not hurt. And this is particularly true if the child never said no or stop. Some small children do not understand that they have the right to say no to an adult who's in a position of authority over them. Therefore, they don't know they have the right to say stop or no, or please don't do that any longer. Even older children who are in a position, have an adult over them in an authoritative position, particularly in a sporting context or some other spiritual context, commonly may not assert their right to say no when that adult has a position of authority over them. And molesters use that inability of the child to justify and rationalize the child's not harmed, the child not is not hurt, he or she didn't say no, he or she did not say stop. On that same study of 3,952 admitted molesters that we talked about earlier, 70% of the men in that study who abused boys were heterosexual. 70% had sexual relationships with women, sometimes in very normalized context with wives and children, in a sexual interaction on that side of the equation while they were sexually abusing kids. Only 7% in that very large study showed no sexual interest in adults of any form. Of the pedophiles, those who preferred the younger pre-adolescent children, the pedophiles who were molesting girls, their gender of preference was girls. Of those, 21% also molested boys. So they would cross that gender barrier. Of the pedophiles who were molesting boys, they preferred boys as a gender. 53% would also hop over that gender barrier and molest girls as well.
Back in just a couple minutes with Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe. We'll take a look at our weather forecast as well. It's Child Abuse Prevention Month, and this week we're talking about sexual abuse of children in Christian ministry settings. How do we prepare to prevent that? How do we understand what's actually going on? Some of the stuff we're going to be talking about this week is absolutely shocking and eye-opening, but we'll get back to sexual abuse awareness training components. Some of them, just a few of them, we're playing for you here on the air. Next one up, called the grooming process.
Amazing. God accepts us as we are and loves us too much to leave us that way.
Well, if you're just joining us, it is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and we're choosing to look at the issue of sexual abuse of children in Christian settings. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but check out the Christian Post sometime and the number of articles listed there about youth pastors or summer camp directors or others who've inappropriately been involved with children. How do you recognize it? How do you prevent it? Maybe it's a volunteer in the organization. Maybe it's a group of people who are heading an organization. How do you spot it? How do you call it out? How do you prevent it from happening in the first place? Well, that's what we're focused on this week. And some of the segments you'll be hearing are taken literally from the Sexual Abuse Awareness Training, which is hours long, 78 pages of documents that accompany it. It's so thorough. It's ridiculous. But I want you to stick around and get a taste, get a flair for what we're talking about here, because Kimberly Norris, the founder of Ministry Safe, will be with us again tomorrow, and we'll be taking some of your phone calls. So the grooming process, let's talk a bit about that. Let's find out what that looks like and learn a little bit more from Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe.
So what are the conditions that are necessary to offend? What are we looking for as we address this screening process to protect children from sexual predators in our program? The conditions necessary to offend are access to children, privacy. Remember that the molester is looking for trusted time alone with kids in your program. The molester is looking for trusted time alone. He's got to have privacy and the trust of the individuals who are in the program in order to have access to that child and then control, which is the third element of the conditions necessary to offend, control, keeping the child silent. All of these are a part of the molester's or the offender's grooming process. You remember we talked about 90% of kids are molested by somebody they know and trust. We got to grasp again a couple concepts that we pulled from sexual abuse awareness training. Molesters groom children for sexual abuse. The grooming process is the process utilized by the molester to isolate a child, gain access to a specific child, sexually assault that child, and then keep that child silent. That whole process is what's known as the grooming process, and molesters groom children for sexual abuse. As well, primary concept that we pulled from sexual abuse awareness training, if you got nothing else from that training, you should walk away with an understanding that molesters groom the gatekeepers. Molesters groom the gatekeepers in children's programming. If a molester is in your program in order to gain access to kids who are within his age and sex of preference, that molester will be participating in grooming the gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers, as we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training, are you and the folk who are in positions of authority in that program. Anyone through whom the molester has to go in order to have access to kids that he's targeting for sexual abuse, those individuals are gatekeepers. And the molesters are grooming the gatekeepers to have them think that they're trustworthy, helpful, responsible people. Because the molester is looking for trusted time alone with the kids that he's targeting. I want you to hear this concept from two different sides, the idea of molesters grooming the gatekeepers. I want you to hear it from a parent, a set of parents, whose child was sexually molested in the context of children's programming. And then I want you to hear it on the other side, from the mouth of a molester, describing the concept, describing the process of grooming the gatekeepers.
When you first met the man who molested your daughter, what was your impression of him?
Just charismatic. I mean, just he's one of those people, when you walked into the door, he was one of those first people to meet you at the door with a strong hug, you know, never a handshake, a hug from all of us, you know, me, my husband, the kids, a hug. If their kids were sick, somebody wasn't there, always concerned, call, you know, how's your daughter, how's your son, I don't see him here today. Just very, very outgoing, charismatic person.
And it extended outside the walls of our church, basically. He would do a lot of volunteer things, help with people who were sick, and if you were, your car was broken down in the desert, he'd be the first one to probably zoom out there and give you gas or whatever. He'd give you the shirt off your back, basically, his back, to help you out. At least it seemed that way.
And what did you come to learn later on?
That he was gaining our trust for a reason, you know. He made sure that we looked at him the way we did. Because with us, we were very protective parents. Our kids didn't go to anybody's houses. They didn't sleep over at anybody's houses, only family. And, you know, even though we thought about it when that invitation came, we've just let it go because of the person he was and the person his wife was, you know. So we trusted them.
And how many victims did you have total?
I have a total of 24 now. And I'm looking to see if I have any more.
And were these, you said these were all kids except two, right?
No. Oh, yeah, well, they were under the age of 18. Most of my victims were the age of 11 to 16.
And how did you get control of them? Was it through force and control and violence?
It was manipulation. No, it wasn't violence. It was more like manipulation. It was coercion. It was like, I'll buy you this, I'll give you that. You know, and treating them like a person, but they were just objects. They were just objects. I was doing anything in my power to get them to give sex up, to give it up. The best way to fool people is to help them. is to ask what they want, ask what they need. Do they need any help doing anything? Do they need any money, or do they need their car fixed? Do they need the grass cut? Do they need their children looked out for? Do they need a job? Do they need anything to get them to think that I am a decent person and want to help? Trust me, I will help. And overall, that was a flat-out lie.
So I want to quickly walk through the grooming process, the process utilized by the molester to gain access, carve out, push barriers, sexually assault or sexually touch a child, and then keep that child silent. I want to walk you through the grooming process briefly, talk about some grooming behaviors, and then we'll get directly into the screening elements that we need to have in place in order to protect kids and children's programming. And first of all, first step in the grooming process, refer back to the information that you received in sexual abuse awareness training, gaining access to specific kids. This is commonly going to start, if we think about that male molester who's participating in all these offender studies when they do get criminally prosecuted, if male molester is having his first victim at 13 or 14 years of age, then most male molesters are starting their paths of abuse either within the family or with family friends or in places where they're spending time. So those initial offenses are going to be pretty close to home, but they're going to move off into career and volunteer opportunities related to children because that's where those kids are going to be who are within his age and sex of preference. They're going to gain the trust of the child's caregivers. That's the grooming the gatekeepers context or concept that we've talked about. They're going to create the appearance of being helpful, kind, trustworthy, and they tend to be pretty skilled at meeting a child's needs. Now, obviously, that skill is misplaced and the motivation is poor, but they tend to be pretty good at figuring out what does a child need, what does a child want, what does a child want to do. Pretty good at that, superficially at least. The second part of the grooming process is going to be selecting a child, selecting specific child or children in order to prepare them for sexual abuse. And this is commonly going to be a child who's on the fringe or in need in some form. You can be on the fringe for a lot of different reasons. I represented a girl a few years back who was on the fringe in her particular paradigm because she was stunningly beautiful. Therefore, she was a little bit off-putting to the girls who didn't want to be compared to her, and the young men were incredibly intimidated by her. So you can be on the fringe for a lot of different reasons. Commonly, kids who are on the fringe are those who, when you gather them to play, they're those kids who are not necessarily engaged in the big knot. Even older kids as they play, junior high, high school kids, get them together and they end up in a big knot in conversation and kind of horsing around together and joking. And those kids who are on the edges of that and on the fringes of that tend to be the kids who are targeted. There are certainly exceptions to this principle, but they tend to be those kids who are kind of on the fringe. Can be a child who's looking for someone to follow or trust, or a child who's from a broken family or a single parent home who therefore may feel a lack of regular and effective adult affection and interaction because mom or dad in a single parent household lacks time to do that. So it can also be a child involved in alcohol or drugs at present. This creates an easy entree for the molester because by providing them alcohol or drugs, which by definition will have to be secret, we can assume that mom or dad's not really excited about that, can carve that child out through this portion or part of the grooming process to gain access to them, select that specific child, and wrap secrecy into the equation. It can be a child already interested in pornography and sex. And you know, the average age in America today at which a young man is first exposed to pornography is 8 years of age. On average in America, a young man is exposed to pornography for the first time at 8 years of age. So this age at which pornographic images are going to be compelling, particularly to a young man, is getting younger all the time. And molesters will use that interest in pornography and that natural interest in sex to target specific children because the barriers are already somewhat lower based on their natural curiosity or their existing exposure to pornography or sexual topics or just sexual interest. At this point, the molester is going to introduce nudity and sexual touch. This is going to always involve barrier testing and erosion, pushing back those physical barriers. Everybody starts out with a sense of personal space. Personal space is larger in some states than others. I'm from Texas. We got a lot of personal space. If I move to a place that had a lot less space, if I go to New York City and ride the subway every day, my sense of personal space can be moved by my personal experiences. Molesters use frequent touch and pushing back those places where kids have a natural sense of personal space. By pushing those barriers, they're able to move back what the child is able to contemplate or what is that child is comfortable with physically, as well as with subject matters, conversation, materials that they're exposed to. So they're going to push back on those natural barriers that children have and erode those barriers physically, sexual topics and discussions. They're going to incorporate playful touch and what we refer to as accidental nudity. Playful touch, almost always with a male-male scenario, almost always is going to involve wrestling. Wedgies, pantsing, other types of playful touch, which would fall in the category of any sort of touch that becomes acceptable because the playful context in which it occurs, but it would not be acceptable if that individual just walked up to the child and did it. So playful touch, accidental nudity, circumstances where clothes come off and it appears to be just a funny thing. These are contexts used by the molester to introduce nudity and sexual touch. Creating a culture of nudity or sexual joking is another part of this portion of the grooming process. And then last on our list, magazines and movies depicting nudity and sex. Again, males, men, are visual. Young boys are therefore visual. Every case we've ever handled with a male molester and a male victim has involved the use of pornography, without exception. Every case we've ever been involved in, that pornography has been used by the molester, but it's always been male-female pornography. It's never been male-male pornography, because the male molester assumes the young man is interested in the female form, and the molester is using that pornography to open and to create an appetite, open the sexual conversation, use that piece of material or that pornography to push into a comfort level that the child otherwise wouldn't have. As well, because it's pornographic and because most parents would not be okay with that, secrecy is woven into that as well. Very common use in this part of the grooming process. After sexual touch has occurred, it's very important to the molester to keep the victim silent. And the molester is going to use that with secrecy, which has been woven into the entire equation. Giving the child stuff, giving the young man or young woman privileges, allowing them to break the rules, allowing them to do things that otherwise parents wouldn't be okay with. Secrecy tends to be woven into the entire equation, whether that's privileges, stuff, buying them things, exposing them to pornography, cigarettes, beer, alcohol, illicit drugs. Secrecy tends to be wrapped into the entire equation. Then the molester is going to use shame and embarrassment to keep the children or the child silent, embarrassing them or using their own bodily response to shame them into silence. Young children especially do not know that human bodies have predictable physiological response to sexual touch. Kids who are going through puberty commonly don't yet understand that the human body has a predictable physiological response to sexual touch. And the molester will use that response that the child's body evidences to shame that child into silence, saying, you wanted it, you participated in it, you liked it, et cetera, et cetera. If you tell, you'll get in trouble too. As well, the molester will use threats to keep a child silent. These can be very direct. They can be much more subtle. Number one reason why kids don't tell: no one will believe me if I tell. And all too often, this is the case. This is because molesters groom the gatekeepers. This is because molesters commonly choose children who are on the fringe in some way. Not always the case, but it's common. And therefore, these children believe, if I tell, no one will believe me. On average, in the U.S. today, before a criminal prosecution will occur, a child has to tell seven adults. Seven adults before a criminal prosecution will incept related to child sexual abuse. Another very direct threat would be, if you tell, I'll hurt you. If you tell, I'll kill you. If you tell, I'll kill your pet. Very direct threats. More subtle threats, if you tell, your mom won't be able to handle this. I think you liked it. If you tell, you'll get in trouble too. This would wreck our sports program. This would wreck our team. So on and so forth. That would be a much more subtle threat. So some of the common grooming behaviors that we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training, our underlying training, these are going to become important too as we address an effective screening process. Because as we discussed earlier, and as we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And part of what we're looking for in those past behaviors in an effective screening process is we're looking for these common grooming behaviors. We're going to include in our screening process questions that are meant to elicit a high-risk response. And then we're going to look for those high-risk responses, taking into account abuser characteristics, these common grooming behaviors, and some specific male and female offender characteristics that we're going to talk about later on. So common grooming behaviors, the top of the list, the top, you know, six or eight, if you will, that we see in offender studies happening throughout the United States. And at the top of our list, gift giving, giving kids stuff, giving them privileges, buying them things that they want. Remember I said earlier that molesters tend to be pretty good at figuring out what a child wants or needs. And so once they figure out what they want or need, they start giving it to them. This is top of the list in terms of common grooming behaviors. Kid magnet activities, gathering around the molester things that the child who's within his age and sex of preference would like to do. So gathering around himself kid magnet activities or stuff that a child within his age and sex of preference would like to do. Classic example is video games for a specific age and sex of child, probably middle school boy or thereabouts. Touchy with children or pushing physical boundaries. We talked about as part of the grooming process that barrier testing and erosion. So a common grooming behavior is for the molester to be touchy with children and pushing back those physical barriers, pushing back what that child is used to or is willing to entertain in terms of touch. As we discussed in sexual abuse awareness training, not going to go into it much here, we're not suggesting don't touch your kids. That's not the takeaway here. But you should understand that molesters tend to be very touchy with kids because they're consistently pushing back those physical barriers. We address this in sexual abuse awareness training. We talk about appropriate forms of physical affection with kids in our program and those types of physical affection that we should stay away from. It should be addressed in your policies and procedures. We're not going to address it here. Repeated time alone with the same child. This would be another common grooming behavior. One-to-one, unsupervised, trusted time alone, repeatedly with the same child is another common grooming behavior. Next on our list, breaking the rules and then justifying and rationalizing the rule breaking. Breaking the rules in the program, and this could be providing pornography, tobacco, beer, breaking the rules in a camp context, breaking the rules in a sporting context, being someplace you're not supposed to be at a time you're not supposed to be there. Breaking the rules and then justifying and rationalizing the rule breaking. Here's why it was okay that I broke the rules. Yes, I knew it was a rule. Here's why it's okay that I broke it. Common grooming behaviors. Playful but inappropriate touching. We kind of touched on this already. Playful but inappropriate touching. Wrestling. Wedgies, pantsing, cup checks, using a towel to pop a kid in the shower. These types of playful but inappropriate touching utilized by the molester to participate in barrier testing and erosion to push back what the child is used to or will accept in terms of touch.
You've been listening to a portion of the sexual abuse awareness training provided by Ministry Safe. They've trained some 2 million people to be better equipped to deal with sexual abuse and prevent it in especially churches and ministry settings, and definitely in homes. If you're a parent and you'd like to receive an hour of training for parents, exclusively for parents, that's free, just go to ministrysafe.com/April. And since it's Child Abuse Prevention Month, that training for you is absolutely free. ministrysafe.com/April, or go to wdcxradio.com. We've got it pinned right to the top of our Facebook page, and you can click on it and access it right there. We'll be back with more of NBL in just a moment. What do you do if a child reports? What if a child says they've in fact been abused? How does that get dealt with?
Maybe you should just quit trying harder. I have news for you. It doesn't work.
Let's get back to it. We're going to be talking about this all week long. Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, who you've been listening to, will be with us again tomorrow. We'll have the phone lines open and look forward to having some conversation with you. In fact, later in the week, we're going to wrap up the sexual abuse awareness stuff and then discuss how to implement an effective safety system in ministry environments. And then we'll have some flat-out Q&A on Thursday. So be preparing your questions, your comments. Bottom line is, parents are not well equipped to equip their own kids to recognize this and to know what to do if something inappropriate happens, how to spot abusers, you know, how to make sure that ministry environments are safe, not only for your kids, but for any who are visiting your church or ministry. It's why we're gearing up this month, and we're bringing some of this information to you just to help you understand that this information is available and it's necessary. So I hope that you're enjoying what you're listening to. Let's get back to it here. Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe, what to do if a child reports a problem?
So in this segment, we're going to start a conversation about creating a model of care for abuse survivors and addressing child sexual abuse in ministry context. And we're going to start this conversation by talking about what we do and what should be communicated to church staff members, ministry staff members, when a child reports abuse, when an allegation comes into your frame of reference or comes to one of your staff members, comes to one of your volunteers, from a child or really from any other source, but particularly when it comes from a child of any age. First and foremost, we need to prepare our church staff members and volunteers, the adults in these circumstances, to listen and respond calmly. In a circumstance where a child comes to a caring adult communicating about child sexual abuse, the child needs that individual to act as the adult and to listen and respond very calmly rather than having any sort of emotional outburst or reaction related to the information that's being shared. As well, it's very important that the adult in this circumstance, that your staff members or volunteers, be trained to be sensitive to vague or partial disclosures. Very common for younger children in particular to come to a caring adult and communicate a piece of information that's part of what's been occurring in his or her life. Remember that 2 out of 3 kids who are sexually abused don't tell until they're adults, if they tell at all. So if a child is coming to an adult and sharing circumstances or allegations of sexual abuse, they're commonly going to come in a vague or partial form. So it's very appropriate to ask open-ended questions, questions like, what happened next? Or is there something else you'd like to tell me? Those types of questions that are open-ended and don't suggest any particular behavior or any particular occurrence, completely appropriate. What happened next? Is there something else you'd like to tell me? Is there anything else that happened in that circumstance? What you don't want to do, and you want to train your staff members and volunteers not to do, is to ask questions that assume certain events occurred. You don't want to put thoughts in that child's mind or mouth about what occurred that did not occur. But you want to be sensitive to vague or partial disclosures. Remember that the number one reason why kids don't tell about child sexual abuse, in every study that has come down in the last 20, 30 some odd years, number one reason kids don't tell is because
If I tell, no one will believe me. So this has such a profound impact on children who've been sexually abused. They've commonly been told by their molester, if you tell, no one's going to believe you. And this also yields vague or partial disclosures to adults because they feel they won't be believed. So one very important element of communicating with a child who's trying to communicate information to you, if you can say so truthfully, simply saying, I believe what you're telling me, can be very compelling to a child. Even an older child or teen who has been groomed into believing, if I tell, no one will believe me, has a difficult time putting all of the information or all the allegation before you in one setting. So what will happen instead is a child will take a piece of the information and kind of float it past you and see how you respond to the information you just received, rather than communicating the entire allegation. Younger children commonly don't have the vocabulary to speak in terminology that's clinical. So they're not going to give you an explanation that would necessarily be received as some sort of clinical explanation of child sexual abuse. So be sensitive to what may be a vague disclosure. We don't want to ask shaming questions, and that seems so self-evident. The most common shaming question that I hear in the work that we do in the law firm is this one: how long has this been happening? How come you didn't tell anybody sooner? Why didn't you let us know what was happening? What time was it when that circumstance occurred? Was it after midnight? Were you someplace you weren't supposed to be, or participating in some kind of activity that you weren't supposed to be participating in? So asking questions that are shaming to the child. What were you wearing would be another example of a shaming question. So we don't want to ask shaming questions of a child who's trying to communicate about child sexual abuse. We would want to report to a supervisor immediately, and creating a culture in your ministry, in your church congregation, creating a culture where staff members and volunteers understand that they don't just have the right, they have a responsibility to report to supervisors allegations or suspicions of abuse or information that comes to them related to an allegation. Creating a communication of culture in your ministry where staff members and volunteers understand that they have this responsibility is very important. We advocate that you actually name specific people and communicate to staff members and volunteers, here's who you tell. Can't be just one. Having at least three individuals, here's who you tell in your ministry or congregation. It's okay for staff members to communicate directly to supervisors and leave it at that, so long as that information gets up to you and others who can take action on behalf of the church to protect the child. So we want to create a culture of communication such that your staff members and volunteers understand that this information needs to be reported immediately to a supervisor. Whether it's simply a boundary violation or a full-scale child sexual abuse allegation, that this information needs to be communicated up. In every circumstance where Greg or I go into a ministry or church scenario where an allegation has occurred, in circumstances where the train has left the tracks, in every one of those scenarios, when we go in and have a conversation with individuals after the fact, what we learn is that various individuals knew about certain aspects of the allegation or the circumstance that led to the sexual abuse, or even the environment that allowed the sexual abuse to occur. Individuals knew pieces of the puzzle. As one person saw this, another one heard that, a child communicated this to a third. But that information, because it wasn't put together in any cogent form and communicated to supervisors or leadership, it was not, the pieces of the puzzle weren't put together before the behavior became unethical or illegal. So a culture of communication, an important element of your safety system. We want to report to authorities where that's appropriate. We're going to spend a lot of time in another segment talking about reporting requirements. Probably the most common phone call we get in the law firm, it relates to, is this something that should be reported? And as Greg said in another segment, when in doubt, report is the safest route for your ministry. It's probably the safest route for the child involved. Unequivocally, it's the safest route for your ministry. And this is particularly the case when any aspect of the allegation involves one of your employees or one of your volunteers, because any action other than a report looks like a cover-up to the public at large. You don't want to be in that circumstance. So reporting to law enforcement is an important part of the steps that you should have in place related to an allegation of child sexual abuse. And then last, no secrets. This again sounds kind of self-evident. No secrets related to children who are attempting to report sexual abuse. But here's how it comes up. A child comes to a trusted adult and says to that adult, if I tell you something, can you keep it secret? If I tell you something, can you keep this confidential? And what the adult wants to say is, of course I can keep that confidential for you. But you've got to put some words in the mouths of your staff members and volunteers. And those words need to sound something like this. There are some things I cannot keep secret. Because if you're being harmed or if another child is being harmed, I cannot keep that information secret. The worst case scenarios are when your volunteer or staff member receives this information and does keep it confidential or secret. Those are the real train wrecks for ministries. But putting those words into your staff member and volunteers' mouths, there are some things we can't keep secret. They have to be, if you tell me, it will have to be reported to my supervisor, it will have to be reported to law enforcement. No secrets as it relates to a child attempting to report an allegation of sexual abuse. Now, some people ask, does this mean if this occurs and if I tell a child there's some things I can't keep secret, is that going to chill that child's willingness to tell me about what happened? And the short answer can be yes. It might chill what's the communication that occurs at that point. But this is probably preferable to a circumstance occurring where you promise confidentiality, the child tells you something that has to be reported to law enforcement. Now you're in a situation where you have to report, both because it's ethically responsible, because it protects the child, and because it's the law. And you've got to go back to that child and communicate that this information that they thought they were communicating in a confidential way can no longer remain confidential. So that's not a scenario that you want to be in. I see this particularly prevalent across the board, really, but in high school ministry, we see this a lot, where a teen will come to a typically college-age volunteer and communicate about sexual abuse they've experienced in the past or sexual abuse that they're currently experiencing. And that college-age volunteer, who is relatively close in age to this teenager anyway, wants to keep that information confidential because it feels like such a personal matter. But you've got to train this in to your college volunteers, your volunteers across the board, but your college-age employees and volunteers, that even though this is a personal disclosure, some of those pieces of information have to be reported to law enforcement. And it's not only right and ethical and the law, it's also the most protective route to take to protect that child from further abuse. So no secrets when a child reports.
Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe will be making herself available to us tomorrow. We'll take some live phone calls, and so prepare some of your questions. And by the way, she'll be with us on Thursday as well for a major Q&A session about all of this. We've got a lot of ground to cover this week. When we come back, we'll talk about reporting requirements because, you know, there are folks, ministers especially, but others who are mandatory reporters. When you discover that child abuse has occurred, you have a legal obligation to report it. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about a well-loved deacon who's been a part of the church for 50 years. You have a legal obligation to report it. So what are the reporting requirements? Well, it's a lengthy and complicated section. We're going to play a portion of it for you when NBL returns on WDCX. It's gonna be.
The Apostle Paul said, "Are you foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, will you now be perfected by the flesh? So you think you have eternal life by faith? but can you be made perfect by good works? Really?
You know, just a heads up, if you've been listening today, some of the segments I'm playing are just portions of much larger segments. The accompanying catalog or document that goes along with this, the accompanying workbook that goes along with all this training is 78 pages long. So we obviously can't bring it all to you, but we're giving you an idea of the kinds of things that are covered, including reporting requirements. What to do if a child reports? How does that get handled in a church or ministry setting?
So this last topic is all about reporting abuse, which includes reporting to the authorities and reporting to supervisors. First, let's talk about reporting to the authorities. It's important to note that every state in the U.S. has legislation that covers the requirement to report. These pieces of legislation vary from state to state, but they do have some things in common. Some of these commonalities are that they describe what abuse and neglect are, who is required to report, and to whom that report needs to be made. And usually there is a time frame within which that report needs to be made. This leads me to a term that may be new to you, and that is mandatory reporter. Mandatory reporters are the people who are required by law to report abuse. Oftentimes, legislation will make a list of who these specific people are. While some states simply mandate that all adults in the respective state are considered mandatory reporters. Anyone who is not a mandatory reporter under the law is a permissive reporter. In some states, all adults are mandatory reporters, but in states that specifically list who is required to report, anyone not on that list is a permissive reporter and encouraged to report. The various state laws will also contain some instructions about how a matter is to be reported, to whom it needs to be reported, as well as whether or not an oral report needs to be followed by a written report. In some states, some licensed professionals have additional reporting obligations described in their state's laws. The point is this: though the laws from state to state have similarities, every state has its own legislation, and it's important that you understand what that legislation is in the state where you live or in the state where you're serving children. You must also understand that these pieces of legislation are constantly changing. So it's not enough to understand what the law says today. You have to know what the law is and then periodically check to see if there's been any changes in legislation. Also keep in mind that many organizations may have staff members who are mandatory reporters and some who are permissive reporters, like a camp in some states, where the nurse is under different requirements than a registration volunteer. Understand the law and the obligations of your organization's staff. Remember, when in doubt, report. Let's talk about what to report. The various laws require that we report suspicions of abuse and neglect. First of all, do not miss the requirement to report suspicions, not confirmations. We're not required to investigate as a condition of reporting or try to verify, get proof, or witnesses. The laws require us to report suspicions of abuse, which is intentionally broad. Additionally, abuse is broadly described, oftentimes including sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. But as it relates to sexual abuse and the requirement to report, keep the definition in mind that we discussed at the very beginning of this training. Any tricked, forced, manipulated, or coerced sexual activity for the pleasure of the abuser. And remember, this definition is very broad by design. So the best rule to follow is the one I mentioned earlier. When in doubt, report.
In addition, where reporting is concerned, a good rule of thumb is don't let the sun set on it. If it came to your attention today, report it today. In every state, both mandatory and permissive reporters enjoy civil and criminal immunities when a report is made in good faith. These immunities protect the reporter from lawsuits and criminal prosecution so long as the report was made in good faith. And a good faith report is any report made without actual malicious intent or with information known to be false. In the law firm, we occasionally receive a phone call from an individual who asks about reporting requirements and says, "What if I'm wrong about this suspicion of abuse or allegation?" So the whole point of legal reporting requirements is to protect the child. Essentially, the legislature has determined that the safety of the child outweighs any inconvenience to the accused adult or an aggressor child. For reporting purposes, an allegation is a reportable event, whether the allegation is believed to be credible or not. In other words, for purposes of reporting, an allegation should be reported as if it's believed to be credible. It is not our job to investigate to determine credibility. That's the work of trained professionals in law enforcement or child protective agencies. Finally, be aware that all governmental entities have criminal ramifications for failure to report. When a mandatory reporter fails to report a suspicion or allegation of sexual abuse, it's not just harmful to the child, it's a crime.
We've discussed reporting to the authorities. Now let's discuss the need to report to supervisors. Now, first and foremost, if there's a circumstance that leads to a report to the authorities, let a supervisor know so he or she can take steps to protect the child, as well as any others in the program who may be at risk. But for those concerns that don't necessarily rise to the level of reporting to the authorities, there still exists the importance of creating a culture of communication. In other words, everyone who wears a name tag should understand that the lines of communication are open with an expectation that they will be utilized, especially about any possible grooming behavior. This means you should communicate with leaders or supervisors when you see policy violations, especially violations that line up with some of these common grooming behaviors or any phase of the grooming process. It's important to remember, this is not a witch hunt. It's simply consistent with the principle that if you see something, say something. If we all have a responsibility to communicate policy violations to supervisors or administrators, that leader can take the collective information and see a bigger picture, such that problematic behavior can be addressed before it becomes harmful or abusive. Like I mentioned before, if you see something, say something. But remember, the goal here is to replace misconceptions with good information, because what we believe also shapes what we see. And we have to first see the problem before we can act to protect the children in our care.
You've been listening to Gregory Love and his wife, Kimberly Norris of Ministry Safe. We're going to be focusing on the sexual abuse awareness training they provide through the organization in an effort to get Christians in our listening area geared up and better acquainted with the resources that are available to arm ourselves against the sexual abuse of children in our homes, in our churches, and in Christian ministry settings everywhere.